commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is the Contracting Experience, connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
This podcast episode and the mention or appearance of external links does not constitute or imply official endorsement on behalf of the U.S. Department of the Air Force or Department of Defense. The Department of the Air Force does not endorse any non-federal entities, companies, products, or services. Moreover, the Department of the Air Force does not exercise any responsibility or oversight of the content at external link destinations mentioned during this podcast. The views expressed within this podcast are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we look forward to a powerful conversation with a true trailblazer in the federal contracting world, Ms. Lauren Wittenberg-Weiner. Lauren is the co-founder of WWC Global, a company that grew from a small military spouse-led consultancy into a multi-million-dollar powerhouse, ultimately securing a $200 million contract with U.S. Special Operations Command. She continues her work as a thought leader, mentor, and advocate for mission-driven acquisition and meaningful change. Welcome, Lauren. Thanks for joining us.
I can't tell you how excited I am to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, no, this is great. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So to start things off, I'd love to go back to hear more about your origin story. Can you walk our listeners through your personal and professional journey that led to founding WWC Global?
Yeah, so I never intended to start a government contracting firm or any firm for that matter. I am not an entrepreneur by kind of expectation. I always call myself an accidental entrepreneur because I was, you know, perfectly happy in my White House job. I had gotten this great, amazing job in the rulemaking office within the Office of Management and Budget, which sits in the White House complex. And I met a guy who ended up being my husband in the long run, but he got an offer just before he proposed. He got an offer to go over to Naples, Italy. So his proposal was, will you marry me, follow me on military orders, sell the house, quit your dream job, and get over there? And we ended up over in Italy, where I found out that military spouses had a pretty big challenge in pursuing professional level careers, particularly overseas, but really almost everywhere. And I didn't do well sitting home, particularly after having, you know, been at the White House, where I was working probably, I don't know, 12, 14, 16 hour days most days. So to come to a screeching halt was not comfortable for me. So I ended up starting the company really just to get work back to the States until I could get home and restart my federal career. And instead, it kind of took off. So WWC was born out of necessity and out of me not being able to sit home and or take any more USO tours of Naples and the surrounding areas. It really was never meant to be what it turned out to be, which was a, you know, $100 million firm in annual revenue over the course of 20 years.
All right. Excellent. Thanks for sharing that. And again, that's a little insight for all of our military spouses out there. You know, if you don't find the opportunities you're looking for, just make your own, right? That's awesome. Then, as your company began to scale, so what did you learn about federal acquisition culture, both its strengths and maybe some sticking points as you transition from small business set-asides to full and open competition?
So I'll say, first and foremost, we actually started, the first thing that we did was we got a subcontract and worked with a great prime and a couple of great primes in the first couple of years, while we got ourselves set up. But once we were, now granted, this was back in the mid, I don't know, probably 2006, 2007 timeframe, where things were very much different. We were actually full and open from the outset. We only started using any sort of set asides somewhere around the 2013, 2014, 2015 timeframe. So we competed all of our work. A lot of it was overseas and there were no set asides overseas, but we competed most of our work full and open. And we were prime on almost all of our work within the first 2 or 3 years. That's not the same as it is now. And so, you know, one of the things I think I learned is federal contracting changes regularly. And if you're not looking at what those changes look like, you're going to be left behind. So you always have to be keeping up with where the federal contract universe is going and what vehicles there are, what requirements there are, who you should be teaming with, what size the contracts are going to be. All of that kind of stuff really does change your strategy. So our strategy in 2006, 2007 was very different than our strategy in 2015, not just because of the size of the firm, but because of the federal contracting universe and what was going on there.
All right, that's great. So along with that, some mid-tier firms often talk about falling into this no man's land between small and large business, or what we call maybe that valley of death. So what was the transition like for WWC, and what changes would you recommend to help companies bridge that gap more effectively?
Yeah, so the valley of death, it's funny, I remember talking to one of our firms that mentored us, and they were going through the valley of death before we ever contemplated getting there. And I remember thinking, oh, poor you, you're just, you know, you're so big that you're about to hit this wall. And then, you know, we came closer to hitting it and realized, wow, this really is a lot harder than it seems. What I did was I sat with probably 30 different firms as we were coming up. At the time, our NAICS code, it was $15 million over 3 years was the average to then come out of our size standard. And we had been around 15 million, maybe a year at that point, 2 years as we were growing out. And I sat down as I was looking at this this kind of cliff that we were going to hit. I sat down with, like I said, probably 30 firms that had done it well or not done it well, or had done it well and then come back under, you know, all sorts of different firms. And the good news is, because we had created such great relationships with all those firms, they were really open and honest with us about what they did well and what they did poorly. And so what I was able to do was create a valley of death strategic plan. And what it did was we actually had, and I still have the screenshot of that PowerPoint slide somewhere in my files. But what we did is we said, okay, look, we're going to be at 15, but we're going to come out. We have to come out big. We can't eke over. That was one of the biggest lessons learned. So we've got to get one big contract. And then from that one big contract, we need to leverage into a couple of medium-sized contracts. And then we need to leverage into some of the best-in-class vehicles so that we can have a ramp to be small while we, you know, stay in that small category as long as possible. And then we had a bunch of other stuff that we were going to do from there. What I think we had said about the large contracts is it had to have been at least a $20 million total contract value contract was what we had defined as large. And then two or three $10 to $20 million contracts for the medium-sized ones. Well, we ended up getting a $200 million contract. So that was a little bigger than what we had expected to do. And it really took us from about 15 to 50 million overnight in terms of what we were forward projecting for the year, literally overnight on December 17th. I remember exactly the day. And we were able to leverage that into a couple of really important contract vehicles that allowed us to keep our status for a little longer and really compete against those other mid-tier firms. We were able to leverage that into another set of about $200 million in new awards the next full year after we had started our big contract, which drove us to that $100 million annual revenue within a couple of years. So we were able to kind of hit those wickets, figure out what we were doing, build out those systems and those pieces in place so that we could be a viable mid-tier firm. But it was hard. I think we have done a disservice to the federal contracting companies in the space. And I think most of them end up realizing that's a choice point for them, and almost none of them really organically make it through that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is absolutely significant there. So you talked about the importance of relationships, and there may be a perception out there that it's difficult to break into government contracting without those deep networks. But I think we're also definitely finding a lot more talent and capabilities with new entrants to this government space, and especially those with non-traditional defense contractors. What advice would you offer to those entities that are looking to broaden their networks and seek government contract opportunities?
So I will say that there does need to be some relationship somewhere. So if you don't have it, finding somebody who does, either as a consultant, as an employee, as a partner, is really critical. It is almost impossible to navigate. There are so few firms. I actually use one firm as an exemplar of breaking into government contracting without relationships, because this firm, which is called Tampa Laundry Company, is the only one I know who actually put in a blind bid. She's so smart that she figured it out, and she created the relationship through the contracting process to be able to do it. But it was a fairly small contract. It was, you know, services that were fairly fungible, so she could actually show that she was better than the current incumbent was. So there are so few of those that's the exemplar I use, because it's so extreme that anyone was able to do it. So I feel like you have to figure out some way of learning to navigate the process, because it's really complicated. And the unwritten rules are as important, if not more important, than the written rules to be able to navigate through it. And you have to have some entry point, because it's just really hard to cut through the noise without that.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, we look for mentorship in every other aspect of life where we want to improve, right? So there's certainly no exception here. So a major milestone for WWC that you mentioned was that $200 million award from US SOCOM. So that's an incredibly competitive space. Well, what was your secret sauce there? What set your firm apart in that bid? And what lessons can contracting professionals, maybe both on the government and the industry side, take from it when it comes to structuring opportunities and creating proposals that foster innovation and broader competition?
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is we worked harder than anyone else to get the bid. Everyone worked hard. I don't want to take that away from our other competitors. But we did all of the homework beforehand. I got the right team in place. We got the right team in place. I don't want to say I. We as a team pulled the right team together. We knew who the government needed to see. We knew who was important to the functioning of this contract. We knew who the staff was that were going to be critical, and we got them on our side. I will tell you, we wrote the most beautiful proposal. So that the proposal matters as a kind of frosting on the cake, as it were. We had to do all of the rest of the work first. And all the rest of the work had to be perfect. But then we looked over every word of that proposal. That proposal was a work of art. It truly was. I joke that sometimes proposals need to be Rembrandts and sometimes they need to be street art. That was the Rembrandt of Rembrandts. It was a beautiful proposal, and our proposal team was amazing. Our entire kind of team of all of just not just the prime, but all of the subcontractors brought phenomenal people to bear. And we sat in a conference room for, 2 months. Daily working on that proposal. So we were, I think, ready to go from early on. We got the right pieces in place. We knew what they wanted to see, what they didn't want to see. We had done all of the homework. And then we got the contract and we got protested, right? Repeatedly, which actually was really frustrating, incredibly, it was bad for the government, but in the long run, it actually turned out to be good for us and good for the government because we had some time to work through. Our proposal had exactly how we were going to do this within the transition time. And if we had gotten it and no one protested, we would have gone and run gangbusters at it and succeeded. But that 8-9 months of protest time where we knew we were going to win in the long run because the protest just didn't have enough merit to be sustained gave us the time to really figure it out so that we could actually execute. Because that, I mean, I think that's the other piece of this. Great, swing at the bleachers, get the big win. But if you can't execute that big win, you're done. You get no other chance. You know, if you screw up a small contract, okay, you can fix it. It can be easy to fix because you just throw all of your resources at it. You don't know how you're going to do a big contract. You can sink your whole firm. So it's making sure that not only were we ready to win and prepared to put the proposal in to win, but that we were ready to execute that proposal when we actually got it.
All right. Excellent. Yeah, you kind of alluded to my next question. So in your work across various agencies and different contracts, I'm sure you've encountered a few maybe what we call friction points, right? Maybe in some of those protests you mentioned. So what are some common misunderstandings between government and industry? And how can both sides kind of shift their mindset to foster better collaboration?
Yeah, you know, years ago, OMB put out a memo or a set of memos that they kind of called the myths memos, MYTH myth. So they had the 10 myths, I think it was, around government contracting. And they all circled around this idea that government and industry are at odds, that they are they can't talk to each other. They can't figure this stuff out. And I think that's gotten better over the years. I do think the memo has had started some of those conversations. But I hear, you know, as a GovCon leader, I have heard more times than I can count, I don't look good in stripes. That's not legal. We can't do that, right? And I think there is so much compliance focus that there needs to be, that people get really scared of going outside of the very clear box that they've been taught for 20 years, that maybe their mentor taught them about what government contracting said 20 years ago, and then they've kind of kept that going. So I think from both a government contracting officer standpoint and a government contractor standpoint, and I talk about this a lot, getting back to the source documentation, really understanding what the process requires, but also what it doesn't require and where there's gray that'll get us to the outcome that we need. So lots and lots of conversations before a SOW or a SOO gets put out there, put out a draft, for heaven's sakes, right? Figure this out. Work together. Yes, the government contracting firms are going to try to steer it to what's best for them, But as you get more information, you can kind of, as a government government contracting officer, figure out the pieces that are going to help the government. When you hear back from those of us who are in industry, you can hear what those consistent themes are. And we can have those conversations. Not only are we allowed to, we should be encouraged to have those conversations and really figure out how to get the government what it needs. And I think some of the non-traditional acquisition authorities have given us a little bit more space, even in some of the FAR-based contracting, to be able to do that, because I think people have gotten a little bit more used to having those open conversations in the OTAs, in the SBIRs, and the SITRs, and the PIAs, and all those kind of areas, and in some of the direct award capacities, to be able to have those conversations. And they've carried those over to the competitive FAR-based contracts. I think that's useful.
Oh, definitely. I totally agree. And I think we've moved light years ahead just over the last maybe 5 to 10 years in terms of increased collaboration, better communication, and more flexible acquisition strategies. So, yeah, I think we're definitely trying to improve that old school mindset, which is definitely where I grew up from in my early career. But I definitely think that pendulum is changing, and I think we're seeing a lot of benefits as a result of that increased collaboration. So, yeah, great point, which leads perfectly into my next question. So, you've worn a lot of hats: business owner, leader, speaker, and author. You describe your leadership style as unruly, which is also the title of your recently published book. Can you talk about what you mean by being unruly within the rules, and how that mindset has helped you navigate government acquisition without losing sight of the mission or the people?
Yes. Yeah. So as we sold the company, which I did almost 3 years ago now, I was kind of, you know, doing some soul searching, really thinking about what got us to where we were, what got us to that $100 million kind of unicorn mark. And I realized I always knew that I would always tell my staff to go back to the source documentation, figure out what it actually says. Don't figure out what somebody told you it says, but go back and really look into it. And as I was kind of looking around, doing a bunch of writing for no purpose other than to just get it out of my head and onto a piece of paper, I started realizing there was a theme around: we always followed the rules. We never broke rules. We saw people breaking rules. We saw firms breaking rules right, left, and center and not getting punished for it. Just wasn't the way we were built, right? I was a good girl growing up. I always followed the rules. I always followed the expectations. And that felt very comfortable for me. But I didn't want to feel like a sucker looking at all of these firms that were breaking rules, cheating, doing the wrong thing, and winning. And I wanted to find the way to show ourselves and then later others that you can actually follow the rules and find your own path. And it takes a whole lot more work, right? It takes being a whole lot smarter about what the rules say and don't say, so that we can find the space within the rules. I am a big fan of the Blue Ocean Strategy book by Marla Bone and Kim. I'm pointing, you can't see it, but I'm pointing to it on my bookshelf because it is there and constantly kind of referred to. I think there is a way to find blue ocean, the ocean that is not kind of scrummy with all of the different competitors there. You can find that blue ocean instead of that red ocean, that red water, without finding what I term in the book Blackwater, which is a little bit of a play on kind of the Eric Prince, that era where Blackwater was kind of ascendant and doing things that were eye-poppingly wrong under the rules. I think you can find blue ocean, blue water, without being in the red water that is scrummy and everyone's competing in the same place, but without finding yourself in black water where you're crossing lines and doing the wrong thing. And so unruly kind of was essentially the guidebook to how we found those spaces where we could distinguish ourselves without killing ourselves, without constantly reinventing the wheel, but find those pieces that really mattered, that allowed us to distinguish ourselves within the government contracting space, but also beyond GovCon, right? In personal life, in advocacy, in all of the places that you know, you talked about all of the roles that I played, play a whole lot of roles, and it what I did in Unruly is look across all of those roles, not just your professional roles, and applied those Unruly concepts to everything out there.
Ah, right. That makes absolutely perfect sense. Thanks for that insight. So, one last question for you. What advice would you give to someone just getting started in the acquisition world, either in government or industry, who want to make a meaningful impact over the course of their career?
Yeah, you know what? I think there's a focus on public service that is necessary for government contracting. I saw WWC as an extension of my public service within the White House. We had a tagline that came up before I ever came up with the actual name of the firm. I knew the tagline to the firm even before I think I knew that we had a firm, that was putting good government into practice. I believed in the concept of government. I believe that government doesn't always do the right thing and doesn't always do the best thing, but we can make it marginally better bit by bit by bit, and that the government has power that I think is meaningful and important and plays a critical role. So if we can find the way to make the government better, rather than just look to how can we make money off of the government, I think, honestly, the government realizes that. They know who the players are that are in it, like they are, to drive mission instead of the ones that are in it to drive profit. And so I truly believe you can do both. You know, we made profit. I certainly am not going to look askance at the fact that we made profit. Obviously, we were a for-profit business, but there were plenty of times that we left profit on the table. There were plenty of times we left revenue on the table because it was the wrong way to do things. And I think in the long run, we actually did better because of it.
All right, Lauren. Excellent. Thank you once again. That's a great way to close things out. So, Lauren, thank you so much for sharing your experiences, perceptions, lessons learned, and advice, right, for both of our government and industry acquisition professionals. This has been a great conversation. Do you have any parting shots or other words of wisdom for our podcast listeners?
Gosh, you know, I think just as we are coming into kind of new opportunities, new realms, new all of the stuff that comes along with all the new technologies, if we can focus on what matters to our society as a whole, as if we can focus on kind of we the people and making sure we're doing the right thing for our country, as government acquisition professionals, as government service providers, as citizens, I think that's the most important thing. And you can do that, and again, still do well, but you can do that. And if you focus on that, I think that's the most critical thing we can all do.
Excellent, Lauren. That's a great golden nugget piece of advice there to wrap things up. So, on behalf of the Contracting Experience Podcast, all of our listeners and subscribers, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been an absolute pleasure having you. And, as always, a big thank you to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. As a reminder, you can subscribe to the Contracting Experience Podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to like us, follow us, and subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton, from the AFMC Contracting Digital Division, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.